Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with author Sean Parnell. We'll hear about the second of three spy thriller novels starring Eric Steele. We also have KVCR's Megan Jamerson speaking with CSUSB professor Stuart Sumita about his work as a consultant on the Pixar film Soul, specifically for Mr. Mittens, a cat. We're going to start with Dr. Anthony Hilliard, a practicing cardiologist and host of the relatively new podcast Evening Rounds. KVCR's Benjamin Perper has more.
Dr. Hilliard, thanks for joining us. What was the impetus behind forming this podcast?
It's been a dream of mine for a while, actually. And part of this is, you know, being a patient myself, you know, how do you find a provider or a physician that you think you're going to connect with, right? You know, the human connection is very important in any business, but I think particularly in medicine, it's very, very important. And so one of the things I wanted to try to do is, as I said in the podcast, is to bring these physicians to life. So you as a patient can say, yeah, that's an individual, you know, if you have a particular ailment that fits in a specialty, and over time, obviously, we'll build out that portfolio of physicians that you think you'll connect with and want to seek their expertise for the problem you're having because of that sort of the stuff behind the white coat, as another way to say it. You kind of assume in today's world, right or wrongly, that the majority of physicians are competent and qualified and board certified and have gone through national standard, sort of standardized training programs and so forth. So the practice of medicine or the ability to provide care should be pretty similar. But I think what would separate a good relationship with a physician as a patient and a great relationship would be one that you also feel like you have a connection that extends beyond taking a medicine that they've prescribed or something like that.
Okay, so a lot of this podcast is to kind of humanize these doctors, right?
Exactly right. You know, to show their vulnerabilities, to provide patients with a perspective that these, as you mentioned, that these are individuals who are humans who happen to practice as a physician.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what does the name mean? Is Evening Rounds, is that a doctor thing?
It is. So every physician does morning rounds. And that's exactly what it implies. You know, a patient was admitted overnight or, you know, a patient's been here a couple days. And a physician goes and sees that patient in the morning, sees how they're doing. Are there additional tests that need to be done? Are there conversations that need to be had with other physicians, et cetera? Kind of planning that day. It's pretty, I would say, intentional in its time. You know, it's not, there's a lot of work to be done, right? So you don't spend a lot of time maybe having more in-depth conversations. It's just getting the work done. Evening rounds implies a time of reflection. So not every physician or every scenario would do evening rounds, but in certain situations, evening rounds are the times when, you know, family members of a patient in the hospital has now is off work or have done their responsibilities for the day and are coming back to the hospital. It's a time to sit and have more in-depth conversations, talk about maybe end-of-life issues. And so it's a time of reflection. It's also a time where we aren't as hurried because the day is ending. And so we'll tend to spend the time doing teaching or talking with other colleagues about, you know, the day and things like that. So that's one aspect of this concept of evening rounds. The second part of it to me is it has a more emotional sort of context to it. Evening rounds also implies a time when most people are going home in various occupations, but you are staying at the hospital. And I talk about this a little bit, seeing this, you know, seeing many sunsets from the hospital windows. knowing that there are family events that you're missing, or whether that be birthdays or anniversaries or your kids' music concerts or baseball games and things like that. So it has a pretty powerful emotional overtone because it is a time when you are at the hospital when other occupations may be going home, but there is still work for you to do. And so those are the two sort of components in my mind that comprise the concept of evening rounds for physicians. And so one of the things I wanted to do with the naming of the podcast Evening Rounds is to use it as sort of a play on what we do. And from the standpoint that this, you know, is a fireside chat, you know, there's no tie, the shirt's rolled up. It's a chance to have a conversation of reflection at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about yourself? You're a doctor, obviously, and a professor, right? And now a podcast host. So how do you balance it all?
So I struggle with balance, like I think a lot of folks do. One of the things that I'll reflect back, my mother, when I got accepted to medical school back in 1998, she gave me this book, and it was How to Be a Successful Medical Student. And it was no magic to it. But it basically said you have 24 hours in a day. And in your mind, whether you're actually writing it down or not, it's scheduling the time. So for me, I schedule, as crazy as it sounds, I schedule my downtime. I put it in my Outlook calendar because obviously there's a number of competing entities, you know, whether it's meetings or patient responsibilities. And your day will get comprised of all of those things, and there'll be no time for Anthony or no time for Anthony and his wife, Tammy, or his kids. And so I actually schedule it in. So I try to create that balance. My day begins very early in the morning. It begins usually about 4:30. That's exercise has been a very important part of my life. It's where I clear my head. It's how I reset and prepare for the day. And I exercise 4:30, 4:45, or 5 a.m. every morning. And so my day starts early, and then I am able to get to work early and get a lot of the work done so that if I'm not taking care of patients in the hospital, my evenings aren't spent rounding with patients but are at home with the family.
Yeah, okay. So I understand you have some family history with cardiology conditions, right? Did that kind of inspire or inform your work that you do now?
Absolutely, 100%. I often say I have a fatal attraction to cardiology. When I was a kid, I come from a family of physicians. My father is still a practicing oncologist in the area, and my grandfather, who has since passed, was a family physician in Colorado. And they actually both graduated from Loma Linda. And so I was born and raised in this area. And when I was growing up, I wasn't going to be a physician. I was interested in lots of different things, but that physician draw or the ability to impact patients' lives kept coming back, if you will, and pulling on me. And so as I decided to enter into a career of medicine, it was a no-brainer for me to enter into cardiology. I mean, I knew that when the first day of medical school, you know, was the first day I knew I was going to be a cardiologist. And what do I mean by that? Well, growing up, I have vivid memories of my grandfather seeing his heart attack. We were up in Idaho at a sort of a family camp there, and we were out skiing on a lake, and my grandfather developed chest pain. And I remember my father and one of his friends putting him in the back of our Suburban and just flying down that dirt road to the highway to get him to a hospital. And I remember wondering if I was ever going to see my grandpa again. You know, I was a little kid at the time, and I was fascinated by the fact that 3 days later, when we were done with the camp, we were picking up grandpa and taking him back home with us, you know, and he looked for all the world better. Now, obviously he had some damage to his heart and so forth, but that was lost on me as a kid. And so I was fascinated by that. Someone who looked so sick to me just several days later looked like grandpa again. And so that was my first sort of visual impression of what, you know, can happen to someone who has a heart affliction. And I was like, gosh darn it, you know, I want to help people like that, because that was such a profound story for me to see someone sick and then rapidly recover. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. My dad's brother died in his 50s from advanced cardiovascular disease. And my cousin, his son actually has cardiovascular disease. And my father, ironically, while I was in medical school, had a large anterior myocardial infarction while attending an oncology conference. He's a cancer physician. And so at this point in my life, I'm the only Hilliard of my generation or older who has not had an affliction from cardiovascular disease. So it hits home for Anthony. It hits home for me. And so I was drawn to that specialty, to this specialty, because I know the impact it can have on people, and also to try to figure out how I can do what I can for myself to prevent it from happening to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what's the future of this podcast? What are some goals that you have for it?
So we have a very large practice. We have over 1,000 physicians. And while I sort of run the business of our practice plan and know a lot of physicians by what they do, I actually know very few physicians by who they are. And so I'm excited about the future of this podcast because I'm going to get to learn more about who I think are amazing physicians, but I'm going to get to learn more about who they are as individuals and humans. And I hope the audience that listens to this will find similar joy in learning about who they are. Now, we're also going to talk about some deeper subjects. You know, I one of the things I do want to do is highlight some patient education in each one of these podcasts. And so we will be tying different podcast interviews to different parts of the calendar year. So if it's February's Heart Month, for instance, and then May is like shaken baby syndrome month. And so we'll highlight one of our neurosurgeons then and cancer month and things like that. So I do want to try to have a call to action for patients during those months where there'll be a lot of media attention to those particular ailments.
Yeah. Speaking of timeliness of things, do you think that this podcast coming out during the COVID-19 pandemic has some kind of special significance? Do you think that, I mean, it's especially important right now?
I do. I think one of the things that we, not just Loma Linda, but I think we as a healthcare community is struggling to make a connection with a patient. Most of our visits during the COVID-19 pandemic, so starting March 16, have been virtual. So that's either been like what we're doing here today by telephone or by video. And, you know, while it's still an opportunity to connect with your patients, it's a very difficult way to establish that emotional connection. You know, if you're going to talk to a patient and their family about a procedure, let's say, and you've never actually touched them or listened to them, and you've just seen them via a screen, it's hard to make that connection. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's a real challenge. And I think bringing some physicians' sort of humanness to the picture hopefully will help. If a patient says, yeah, that's my doctor, you know, and I'm hopeful or optimistic that while it's not obviously representative of all 1,000 physicians, because we just simply don't have the bandwidth or the time to do that, that over time we will start bringing more and more of these physicians to life, if you will. And so that connection will be useful. It's also, I mean, we're going to be highlighting some of the challenges during COVID. So Dr. Tan is one of our COVID intensive care doctors, and he's been interviewed and talking about the personal struggles of death and not being able to make everyone well and how to balance that and how do you go home when you've been exposed to COVID. And so, yeah, I think for sure the timeliness of the COVID pandemic has impacted some of the content, and also I think has provided another sort of level of what this podcast can do to help with the emotional connection that our patients deservedly need with their physicians.
That was KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with Dr. Anthony Hilliard, a practicing cardiologist and host of the podcast Evening Rounds, lluh.org. Then search for Evening Rounds Podcast. We'll get you there. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Later in the program, we'll hear from Emmanuel Rogers, checking out some thriller fiction steeped in the world of espionage. First, we have Dr. Stuart Tsumida, a CSUSB biology professor who served as a consultant quite recently for Pixar. KVCR's Megan Jamerson has more.
So you were enlisted by Pixar to help make sure the animation of a cat named Mr. Mittens in the new film Soul was realistic. So what does that mean, and what was your goal?
Well, thanks for having me. What does it mean? Well, one of the things that we see in film and storytelling in general is that whether something is really realistic looking or not so realistic looking, like in, say, a cartoon, is that you have to find something that allows the audience to do what storytellers call suspend disbelief, right? Something that will help them feel so comfortable in the story that they just immerse themselves in the story itself, and they don't worry about what something looks like or how it acts. And so one of the tricks that you use in a film that's got some cartoony-looking characters is to make that cartoony-looking character comfortable as that kind of organism for the viewer. For example, Mr. Mittens is a very round cat. He's built a little bit more like a hamster, but he has to convince the audience that he's a cat and acting like a cat. And so what we'll do is we'll take that shape and we'll try and imbue it with the kinds of say, footsteps or movements or behaviors that a cat would normally engage in, so that the audience goes, yeah, that's a cat. And they don't stop to think that it's maybe a sort of a round cat, because of course, him being a round cat allows them to do certain funny things.
Sure. Yeah. I have to say, I own a cat, and I took particular delight when I was watching the movie and how he moved.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah. That's great to hear.
Yeah. Were there any movements, cat movements, that were particularly tricky to capture in the movie?
Well, actually, that's a great question, because the more you stylize a character, the less it moves like an actual real organism. So, for example, in an earlier project we did with Pixar, Ratatouille, although the main character, Remy, a rat, stood on his hind legs sometimes, he was still sort of shaped like a rat. So he wasn't so hard to make move when he was on all fours. But Mr. Mittens, because he's so round, we had to watch out for things like making sure his forelimbs didn't bump into his hind limbs, especially when he ran. And so it meant that we had to pay very, very, very close attention to not only how an animal runs and its footfall patterns and things like that, but we also had to pay very close attention to its posture, its body position, and things like that, so we wouldn't make limbs bang into one another and things like that. And so that is one of the interesting deep dives that the artists do. Some of these artists know as much about animal locomotion as some of my academic colleagues, which is really, really fun for me.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. It sounds like a balance between the arts and science. Like, so tell me more about how your background as a professor of biology fits into this kind of role.
Well, my specialty within biology is animal anatomy, particularly, in fact, I am a paleontologist. I study fossil animals, we are really into finding fossils. Most of the fossils you find are skeletons, and skeletons are the basis of how a body is constructed in many ways. Not the only basis, but one of the most important ways, because it's to skeletons which muscles attach. And so paleontologists are very, very sort of sensitive to the way skeletons are built and how muscles attach. Well, when you build an animated character, especially in the new digital world, you design a character by shape, but then you put an internal structure in it called a rig, which is essentially like the controlling apparatus of a marionette. And the analog for that is the skeleton. Every joint has to work. So one of the things that's interesting about being an animal biologist and a paleontologist is it has sort of predisposed me to working with riggers, who are the people who design the movement constraints in these characters. And then good old fashioned animation, making them move. Well, that comes in with the kind of study we do and how animals locomote, how their posture works and things like that. So it's really nice in that regard. One of the things that was particular about Soul is when they asked me about cats is that, well, cats are a classic study in animal biology from the undergraduate level all the way up to veterinary, anatomy. So there's a lot of information out there, but it's my job to help translate some of that information to the artists who really know structure, but they don't really care about the names of all the bumps and the bones and things like that.
Sure. Yeah, you have to boil it down to layman's terms, I'm sure.
Right, but it's layman's terms with a remarkable understanding of physics and mathematics and computer science. It's really, really an interesting combination.
That's incredible. And you've sort of touched on that this is, not your first time working with not only Pixar, but you've worked with other major studios like Disney and HBO and Netflix. What's the story of you, how you got started?
Well, it's one of those serendipitous stories. I've had the good fortune of doing this for a number of years. I'll give away my age a little bit if I tell you the first project I ever worked on, which was Disney's hand-animated project, Beauty and the Beast.
Wonderful.
Which might have been made before some of your listeners were even born. But I did my graduate work at UCLA, and while I was there, I met a very interesting fellow named Charles Solomon, who was in the animation department. And we became good friends because I helped him look at rabbits, and he was putting a rabbit in his thesis film. Well, Charles has since become a world famous author and film critic. But way back in the day when we were grad school buddies, as we went off to our first jobs, he said, "Hey, remember all those guys we used to have lunch with? Well, yeah, they have jobs now. And they want you to talk about the stuff we used to talk about at lunch." And that turned out to be Horses and Wolves in Beauty and the Beast.
Wow.
And then the next big project was Lion King. And the snowball sort of kept rolling over the years. At that time, I was at the University of Chicago, transitioning to Cal State San Bernardino. And the first project I worked on when I was out here at San Bernardino was finishing up on Lion King, in fact.
Okay. And you joined Cal State San Bernardino in early 1990s, is that right?
That's right. That's right. So those films were started in the late 80s and finished in the early 90s. And since then, we've worked on hand-drawn films, we've worked on computer-generated films, but no matter what the case, story is king, and you don't get story if you can't suspend disbelief. And so I still have this wonderful sort of niche in helping the artists tell their story.
That's wonderful. Do you have any, I'm sure each film is an incredible experience, but are there any favorites that sort of stand out in your mind?
Well, one of the things I love about my job, where I teach so many different students and I get to do research around the world, is the people I meet and the travel. And so it's the same with the studios. When I get to travel to exciting places and meet interesting people, so I have to say there are some favorites. I mean, Lion King is a sentimental favorite because it's the first really big project I ever worked on. It's the first screen credit I ever got. But I have to say, working on Ratatouille with the Pixar people was a remarkable experience. It is one of my favorite films. And working on Disney's Tarzan, which had both humans and gorillas in it, was great, in part because we did a lot of that work in California and in Paris, France. And who doesn't like going to Paris, France?
Right.
Life of Pi, which was a very different project. I got to vet the entire script with Ang Lee, which was a fascinating experience. And it was a very sort of photorealistic film, which is a very different set of challenges. But when someone like Ang Lee says to you, "So, how would a tiger act in a boat for 100 days? I have no idea, but let's talk about it."
Sure.
So it's hard to pick particular favorites. I've had the good fortune of going through many, many over the years. And each one's a new adventure.
That's wonderful. And I realize that, you know, a lot of these films you're mentioning, you know, these are animals that are grounded in our own reality. Have you ever had gotten the chance to consult on an imaginary creature?
Oh, yes. And that's really funny because one of the first times that happened was with DreamWorks Studios. And I've had a wonderful relationship with them over the years. In fact, I did my sabbatical with them last year, right before we all got sent home because of COVID. But one of my experiences with them was they said, Stuart, what do you know about the anatomy of dragons? And I said, nothing, because they don't really exist. I've never dissected one. But the answer, of course, was, most mythical animals are made out of things we already know. So dragons are made out of bats and birds and pterodactyls and crocodiles and things like that. And inevitably, if you want a flying dragon, then we really have to spend time doing physics because flight is flight. And if it's going to look real, you have to know how flight physics works. So we actually built something there called Flight School. Which was run by their directing animator on all the Dragons films, a remarkably talented gentleman named Simon Otto. And Simon and I got to teach flight physics to the artists. And, you know, it shows. They worked really, really hard to make sure that the wings worked. And we know that dragons don't exist, but when they're in the air, you never question that they could be in the air.
That's amazing.
And that's our job. If we do our job, you never know we were there.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's super fun. So I have gotten to work on some fun projects. And sometimes you work on things that, wouldn't exist, but you can still see their model. So sometimes humanoid characters. I got to work on Guardians of the Galaxy because I teach human anatomy. So there's a big macho male and a green female. Well, they have to move. They have to move differently.
Sure.
So
I have to ask then, what's next, both in your academic research and in your animation consultant work?
You know, I'm very happy you asked about that in that dual fashion, because of course, what we're all waiting for is for the vaccines to be distributed to the point where we can go back live and in person, because my day job is teaching at the university, and I miss my students. I work with them online, but I miss my students because they're inspiring and they're energizing. In terms of our research, my paleontology is such that we've worked in both in the southwestern United States and in Europe. Now, the area of the southwestern United States where we've worked is the area that was sort of the Four Corners area, sort of the desert southwest. And boy, I have to tell you, the COVID issues there are horrific, especially near the native reservations. And so we really can't go back there. Probably not even this summer. We're probably going to be restricted going back the following summer.
Wow.
But we do have ongoing projects. Some of the animals I study are even older than dinosaurs, and so they're only going to be 1 year older. And so we have to be patient. But we are hoping to go back into southeastern Utah and northern New Mexico, hopefully by a couple summers from now.
I hope that works out. Yeah.
Yeah, and the great thing is there's always the film industry is continuing to plug along, and there will be other projects that are coming up this year and next.
Okay, is there anything you can tell us about at this point, or is it kind of
let's see. One of the things that I got to have a hand in while I was at DreamWorks is they are now owned by NBC Universal, who owns the Jurassic franchise. And so I got to work with the folks that did the Netflix series Camp Cretaceous, which is a sort of a kids show in the Jurassic World universe. That was a lot of fun. Season two is starting soon. Talking about weird hybrid creatures, I can't tell you who I worked on, but I can tell you I spoke with Framestore Visual Effects, who are in London and in Canada. Speaking to one of the characters that's going to be in the new Suicide Squad film. But for the kids, probably the most exciting one that's coming up this year will be the long-awaited sequel to DreamWorks' film Spirit, the horse movie, which was massively popular, especially with young girls at the turn of the century. And 20 years later, we have an updated version that's going to hit cinemas, we hope, in September. And if not, it will be streaming somewhere near you. And there are a few others out there as well. Some video game work that I'm not allowed to talk about yet.
Okay.
Disney's next film, Raya, which is going to be about a young girl who chases, dragons again. Because who doesn't love dragons?
Oh, for sure. Well, very nice. Dr. Stuart Sumitha of Cal State San Bernardino, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for the interest and good luck to everybody staying healthy out there.
That was KVCR's Megan Jamerson in conversation with CSUSB Professor Stuart Sumitha. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past KVCR programs are at iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Let's go now to Emmanuel Rogers with more on the second in a series of spy novels, though the third one has also been released by now.
Joining us today is Sean Parnell. Sean is a retired U.S. Army infantry captain who recounted some of his combat experiences along with the soldiers he served with in the best-selling memoir, Outlaw Platoon. Today, Sean is here to speak with us about his latest work, All Out War. Thank you for joining us, Sean, and thank you for your faithful service.
Well, it's an honor to be here, and it was an honor to serve this great country.
It always is, and it's just so good to hear that. Okay, so let me not digress, but carry on. Sean, before we speak more about your new book, All Out War, let's talk a little bit about who you are and some of the things you've done. Now, 9/11/2001 prompted you to join the U.S. Army. What did you hope to accomplish by joining?
Well, you know, in the wake of September 11th, I was just angry and upset. And, you know, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and I grew up in sort of the golden age of America, where we didn't really have any large-scale conflicts. I mean, we had troops deployed all over the world, but, I mean, we've been at war for almost 20 years now, so it's a little bit different time now. And so when 9/11 happened, I was shocked to my core. I didn't know what to do. This was at a time where I was a sophomore in college. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I had no idea what my major was going to be. I didn't really have a path to walk, so to speak.
All right.
Then I watched those towers collapse, and I knew exactly what God had put me on this earth to do, and that was serve something greater than myself and join the military and get in the fight against the terrorists who attacked us. And so, you know, I went down to the recruiter's office like 2 or 3 days later and told that recruiter that I wanted to join the infantry, and not only the infantry, but go to airborne school, and then not just airborne school, but to Ranger school. And I wanted to be a part of America's collective response. And, you know, 4 years after September 11th, I in-processed my unit in the 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, New York, and I took over an infantry platoon, and a year later I found myself in Afghanistan, and boy, were we thrown into the meat grinder.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I was only thankful that, well, you know, it's mixed feelings. I was thankful that I wasn't there, and I was kind of disturbed that I wasn't there at the same time. So
I totally get it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the unique thing about service, isn't it? Is that, you know, the truly remarkable thing about people who serve this country is that you serve, you don't know what's in store for your service. You know that you're going to be issued a pair of boots, you're going to be issued a rifle, and you're going to do your bidding and do your best on behalf of this country. And that's why I say, regardless of the time of service, every generation of American warrior in this country are heroes, because they don't know what they're going to be thrown into.
Never.
You know? Yeah. And so, and you know what's crazy about it is, even knowing what I know now, how terrible and terrible my combat experience was in Afghanistan,
yes,
I would do it all again in a second.
I'm sorry. That just, you know, that's one of those things that makes you feel good about, you know, the soldiers in this country, because they really do feel bad about not being able to join their brothers in such conflicts, as you say, not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah. And ultimately, when I came home from Afghanistan, so I was in Afghanistan, right? I was there for 485 days.
Yes.
My platoon took an 85% casualty rate. I had some of my men wounded twice and three times, and just the fight of a lifetime. And we came home from that conflict in 2007, and it was as if most of America did not even know that a war was going on.
Yeah.
And so that right there, you know, preserving the legacy of my troops, was the catalyst for me writing Outlaw Platoon, my first book, which was nonfiction. You know, being a writer was never in the cards for me. It was not a part of my life's plan, let's just say. But it was just, I wanted Americans to recognize the great sacrifice that my soldiers made on the battlefield for them. And so I took to writing, and that's how I started this soul crazy career. And when Outlaw Platoon came out, in its first week, it was a New York Times bestseller, and then then 30 weeks after, it was a New York Times bestseller. And so nobody was more surprised about that than me. But because of that book's success, I get to write fiction stories now, which is just a dream come true.
All right. Well, let's speak about that for a moment, because for 485 days during 2006 and 2007, you led the most decorated unit in the global war on terror. But with all your successes, one man would lose his life for country. How did that affect you and the rest of your unit?
It was devastating, you know?
Yeah.
So it's crazy. The fact that we only lost one soldier is a blessing.
Yes.
But at the very same time, it's also a curse for a leader, you know?
Yeah.
Every soldier that you lose, it's like a lifetime's worth of tragedy, you know? And it deeply affected our platoon, the soul of our infantry platoon. And, you know, Jeremiah Cole, we lost him on August 16th, 2006. And, you know, for me, I look back on that, and I was on R&R, you know, rest and relaxation leave at home. And by the way, R&R, for those people that don't know, it's mandatory. The Army forces you to go. I didn't want to go, but they force it on you.
Yes.
And the guilt that I feel to this day, I didn't get to experience his funeral. Yeah, I didn't get to be there for the 21-gun salute. And it pains me to this day.
Now, that's amazing, Sean, because you yourself are a Purple Heart recipient. For our audience, will you share with us what that meant to you and those you commanded? Because not many realize that when you receive the Purple Heart, your soldiers do with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I received my Purple Heart on June 10th, 2006, and on that day, my platoon was attacked with, you know, 250-plus enemy fighters, and we only had 24 men on the ground, and we were almost overrun. I was blown up by a rocket-propelled grenade and then subsequently blown up again by a mortar, and I ended up fracturing my skull in three separate places, and every single soldier in my platoon that day on that hilltop with me was wounded as well.
Wow.
I laugh and joke around about it. The Purple Heart, you're awarded the Purple Heart for wounds received in action. And I laugh and I call it the enemy marksmanship badge, meaning I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I didn't move fast enough. But, you know, again, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like I was so lucky, looking back on that experience, to be surrounded by such incredible soldiers. That's the takeaway for me. Yeah, it was a hard fight. We fought up there for 12 straight hours, but I was so blessed and so lucky to be surrounded by such fine Americans.
Right. Well, now this is a hard part, I know, for you. Since you guys returned home, three members of your platoon have taken their own lives. What effect did this have on you, and what organization did you help to co-found for those soldiers in need once they returned home?
It was, Yeah, this was devastating for me. You know, anytime you lose a soldier in combat, it's terrible.
Yes.
And, you know, somehow losing soldiers after you make it home is almost worse. And I think it just speaks to the difficulties that our men and women have when they come home from war. You know, war changes you in some deep fundamental way, and you come home changed.
Yes.
And oftentimes your family doesn't recognize you. Your friends, they don't recognize you. You feel like you don't even have a connection with the people that you love the most in your life, and that can lead to profound isolation and sadness. And in the most tragic circumstances, that isolation and sadness sometimes manifests itself in suicide. And I realized at that moment where we were hemorrhaging men after the fight, after we had already come home, that something needed to be done
right
about, you know, our men and women returning from war. So I helped to co-found the American Warrior Initiative, and it's an organization that just helps smooth the transition for men and women who come home from war, you know. And it started 6 years ago where we started giving mortgage-free homes to veterans, and it's blossomed into, you know, us, you know, giving service dogs to veterans and their families, which has been an unbelievably rewarding mission.
That is great. And do you get a chance to talk to some of the soldiers that you've helped?
Yes. You know, we surprise them at events, and we bring them in as part of their local community. We bring all the community in. We bring soldiers, you know, our military members up on stage, and their community welcomes them. You know, they're smaller events, but we want to make sure that we're welcoming these soldiers home in their own communities, because I personally think that's critically important, that the communities that we live in recognize the sacrifice that we made on their behalf. And so that's a critical component of what we do. So I get to meet these amazing heroes at every single event we do, and we probably do 30 of these events a year. So it's an honor to be a part of it.
Now, Sean, will you take just a moment to share with our audience where they can find out more information, first on your book, All Out War, but also, if you have the information, where they can find more information about the American Warrior Initiative?
Yeah, so you can get my books anywhere books are sold, in all three versions, hardcover, audio, or ebook, whatever you like the most. And you can find out information about the American Warrior Initiative at AmericanWarriorInitiative.com.
Thank you for that. Now, let's get a little bit ahead here. And I really do just want to mention Jeremiah Cole again, because I think his name should be mentioned for us to remember that this man gave his life fighting for this country. So I can't thank him, but I can thank you, his unit, and his family.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And yeah, Jeremiah Cole was an incredible man. He was an incredible man, an incredible soldier, and left behind a wife and a newborn son. And, you know, he was a hero, and I really do appreciate you saying his name like that for your audience.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I do understand. All right. And I know a lot of our audience does also. So now, you wrote Outlaw Platoon as a memoir, and you talked a little bit about that, which I've learned just recently, that this was well written and received. And All Out War, your latest work, your character Eric Steele is an alpha. Will you tell us a bit about Eric Steele and what his designation alpha means for the civilian?
Yeah, so to give you a little background on the alpha program and how I came up with it, the alpha program, I created this program because there were times in Afghanistan where we were targeting high-value targets and planning missions to go after them, and we'd send that information higher for clearance, and by the time we'd get the clearance to go after these bad guys, the bad guys were already gone. And it was so frustrating to me on the battlefield that this was the case. I just thought, man, it would be cool if there were a unit that didn't have to deal with this nightmare, this bureaucratic nonsense.
Oh, yes.
And so I created this program for these books called the Alpha Program. And so there are 9 alphas, which are singleton American operators, each assigned to a different geographic area of the globe. And these alphas, these soldiers, report directly to the President of the United States. So there's no bureaucratic red tape whatsoever. If the President says, go get in the fight, alphas go, and they figure it out on the ground.
Wow. Is this real? Do we have programs?
I wish it were. I I wish it were real. I wish it were, you know, because I think that, you know, obviously it's highly unconstitutional, right? There's no checks and balances with this. But and when you're fighting an asymmetric fight against global terrorism, sometimes you have to move, and you have to move lightning fast to catch these terrorists before they run off.
Yes.
And so alphas, they're supposed, like, the way I conceive this program is they're supposed to give the president a third option. When war is not an option and diplomacy fails, the president sends in an alpha to figure it out on the ground. And once the situation is handled, that alpha reports directly back to the president of the United States and gives thumbs up or thumbs down, and then gets ready, moves on for the next mission.
All right. Now, our time is coming to a close, but I really would like for you, as best you can, to share with our audience what all our war is about and who Eric Steele is.
Well, Eric Steele was a character that was written in the Image of My Soldiers, who's meant to embody the heroism and self-sacrifice that I witnessed from my soldiers on the battlefield. In an all-out war, it happened 6 months after the first book, where Eric Steele is, he took his licks, he was wounded in the first book, so now he's in the recertification process to get back on active status. He passes. First thing he does is dial up his mom, tells his mom to come over for dinner. And as they're having dinner, his house gets attacked, gets burned to the ground, his mother is critically wounded and left for dead, and Eric Steele is unconscious. When he wakes up, he has no idea who attacked him or why, and he goes out on a mission to hunt down the assailants that almost killed his mother. And as he's hunting them down, he realizes that he's been drawn into a much larger conspiracy, and there's a much more deadly game at play right now, a game where world leaders have targets on their back, and Eric Steele jumps into the fight to stop that, to stop those world leaders from being assassinated.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Sean Parnell. We heard mainly about the second book in the series of thriller spy fiction called All Out War, though the third in this series, starring Eric Steele, is out now as well. OfficialSeanParnell.co for more. With that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Emmanuel Rogers and Sean Parnell. Thanks also to Dr. Anthony Hilliard, host of the podcast Evening Rounds. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Megan Jamerson, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. Many past programs can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and NPR One, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.